Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is the Runner's World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Runner's World Podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you the latest training advice, news and interviews from across the world of running. I'm Ben Hobson, the Runner's World Digital Editor, and I'm here with Kerry McCarthy, the Commissioning Editor. Kerry, tell us what's coming up on this episode.
Hiya, this month we are speaking with Hugh Brasher, the Race Director of the London Marathon. Professor Andy Lane will be talking about getting your mental game right for race day. And Mr. Running Tech himself, Kieran Alger, will be popping in to talk about the latest running gizmos that are rocking his world.
Fantastic episode.
Yeah, it's a pretty good lineup, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I'm most interested about Mr. Andy Lane, I think. Not to immediately...
You know he's married, right?
Damn it. So, Kerry, what have you been doing this month?
Oh, good question. Not that... Oh, no, wait. Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Totes forgot. Got on a plane... Went to Tokyo and did my final marathon major.
Woo!
Boom.
Yes. A good day?
Overall, yeah. If you take the big picture, it was obviously a good day because I got to do a marathon, B, I got to do it in Tokyo, and C, it was the sixth one in the set, so I got that big medal afterwards. But it tipped it down. The whole race. Right. Yeah. They put you in start pens quite early, so you're in there sort of up to an hour beforehand. No shelter.
Getting soggy.
And obviously Japanese people are endlessly polite, so everyone was just standing there in kind of like semi-reverential silence, just waiting. So, and I didn't feel that I could move, so right. I just stood there getting like
no one,
rained on.
Because a start pen here is hustling and jumping and bobbing. And
yeah, you know, people sort of banging into each other, testing their GPS and, you know, secretly going for wheeze in the corner and stuff like that.
Or not so secretly.
But there's none of that in Tokyo. So by the time that the gun went and we all crossed the start line, we were sodden, frozen and desperate for a wee.
Right.
But that aside, you know, I was pleasantly surprised. You know, I kind of had a bit of a concern that, you know, Japanese people would not make, say, as raucous spectators as Americans would if you go and do New York or Chicago. And that is true, but I think they've improved a lot in recent years. I was there in 2010 for it, and you know, there's more signs, there's more clapping. You know, they're sort of having a go at shouting out in sort of English and Spanish and stuff to Westerners. Mm. And yeah, it was a really good race, and it's a great feeling crossing the finish line.
Excellent.
Yeah. So, what about you?
I mean, I moved house.
Great.
So I'm treating.
Congratulations.
Thanks. I'm treating the whole experience as cross training.
Right.
So all the boxes and the
lifting your son's toys and stuff like that.
Yeah, everything like that. That was cross training. So I've done a lot of cross training.
Okay.
No, running's been good. I'm meant to be doing a trail race at the end of the month, so it's not. I think with lots of people when they sign up for things, you sign up thinking that the course will be clear all the way to race day, and in fact it has not, and it's been.
Yeah.
So it will. Aspirations have changed. But I'm looking forward to it.
From heroic time to heroic survival.
Well, pretty much survival will be the main thing. Yeah, yeah. But I'm looking forward to it. Some, you know, 15 miles in the mud will be pretty fun.
15 miles?
Yeah, I know. It'll be fine.
But you are a country lad at heart, so I assume
days
of running away from tractors when you were a lad will sort of stand you in good stead for this.
Angry farmers chasing me as I pillage their orchards. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Scrumping my way through my youth.
is the Runner's World podcast.
Coming up next, Rick and Ben spoke to London Marathon race director Hugh Brasher earlier this week about all things to do with the marathon on April the 28th. Here's what he had to say.
Next month, the eyes of the running world will be on London for the 38th year of the Virgin Money London Marathon. For runners fast or fortunate enough to get in, it's bound to be the highlight of their running calendar. So who better to speak to about the event than race director Hugh Brasher? Hugh, welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
No problem at all.
Just to start at the beginning, what are your memories of the very first London Marathon back in 1981?
I think they're really, for me, probably two memories. One is working for 3 days at the Strand Palace Hotel, selling 6,300 train tickets. So I was a 15-year-old, and it was March 1981, and my father needed someone to help, and so I was drafted in, and yeah, I really didn't know what was going on. Just loads of people queuing up outside the Strand Palace Hotel, and there we were in the basement, and there was an exhibition going on, and one of the things that runners had to do was buy a train ticket to get to the start. These days, your number gets you to the start free of charge. So that would be number one, and then number two was at the end of the 3 days being fairly exhausted, going to bed that night. I wake up the next day, don't really watch the marathon, have anything. Don't really think that much about it. And then on Monday morning, I remember getting up and seeing the Daily Mail, and there on the front page was Dick Beardsley and Inga Simonsen hand in hand. And this is the front page of the Daily Mail, and suddenly realizing, wow, something pretty amazing has happened. I have no idea what it was, but I've been a tiny, tiny part of it. And those were the first memories.
Looking forward then to the London Marathon next month. Yeah, I'm lucky enough to be one of the pacers this year. And I know that there's been some changes to the pacing times, particularly there being more pacing for the slower times. What's been the theory behind changing some of those pacing times?
So we do an enormous amount of statistical analysis in the marathon. And people will have noticed that each year the number of finishes that we have had has gone up.
Yeah.
And we've been working, you know, we're sort of 4 years into a plan of how to get more numbers up, and that started off with putting timing mats at the narrowest part of the course, then video cameras, then changing the start process of the marathon last year, changing it again this year, and it's a huge beast in terms of organization and logistical planning. But not only has the demographic of people running the event changed. So again, go back to 1981.
Yeah.
If you ran 3 hours in 1981, you were probably halfway down the field.
Yeah.
If you ran 3 hours now, you're in the top 10% of finishers.
Mm.
So that shows it's become more accessible to everybody. But one of the things that we noticed in our statistical analysis is that there were big clumps of runners, big high density of runners at certain points on the course. And when we actually looked at the data, those points were people running around the pacers. So, you know, we looked at that, and we hope by putting in more pacers, we won't get more clumps, but we'll spread the clumps out more.
Yeah.
So that in turn, you know, we're upping the number. I think it's to 60 this year, and the plan is to take it to 90 the year after. Because the pacers are a great part of the marathon, and knowing the pace that you're running on is something fantastic, especially for first timers. And 55% of people in the marathon and had never run one before.
And it's an incredibly nice problem that you guys have with the London Marathon, but I still guess regard it is a problem, is that you can't accommodate everyone who wants to run. Is there a potential to increase numbers in future races?
Last year was the first time that we put wave starts in, and there are a different wave start. So we're doing it differently to some of the other races. And our waves are going about 5 minutes apart, and there's a huge amount of data gone into it. The reality of how we did it last year reduced runner density on the course and at the finish by 30%.
Wow.
The modelling suggested it should have been 50%. Certain things that we did at the start actually didn't quite work, which is where we ended up with a 30% reduction. The changes that we've made this year should further decrease the runner density. We had incredible crowd support last year, which meant that at certain parts of the course, actually, the crowd were reducing the width of the course. So,
right.
You know, there are so many different parts of this this event that that you only have one opportunity to organise in 365 days.
Yeah.
But we do look at it in incredible detail. Yes, we're upping it, and we have plans to increase it every year to at least 2027, I would say.
Great.
You're also set to hit a massive fundraising landmark this year, this kind of Thanks a Billion campaign that you're doing. So £1 billion of fundraising. Do you see fundraising for good causes as being an integral part of the London Marathon's DNA?
Yes, in a one-word answer.
Yeah.
It is something that has been celebrated for some time, but it's also something I think that people need to be aware of some of the wider aspects of the event, in the sense that these are not our roads. We don't own them. The London Marathon doesn't own them. No individual person does. We have to get permission from the Mayor of London, from Transport for London, who owns some of the roads, from the boroughs themselves. It is getting permission, and the fact that so many charities are benefiting from the event is a great reason that we are allowed to close roads in one of the busiest capital cities in the world. And getting that balance of all the different stakeholders, you know, what we have is pretty well every single entrant, category of entrant, whether they're international runners, whether they're good for age runners, whether they're club runners, whether they're ballot runners, whether they're charity runners, pretty well every single one believes that they should have more places in the marathon. And I can understand why that is, but we really genuinely try and get the balance right. We move it because it is a movable feast, and as we get more numbers, we you know, as we can get more people in, you look at it again and again. So yes, I think it's a really important part of what we do because it allows the event to take place, and it is very much an inspiration. I mean, people have so many different reasons to run, whether it is to run a PB, remember a loved one, to raise money for charity, to start being physically healthy, to improve your mental health. Whatever the reasons are, they should be celebrated, and charity fundraising is absolutely one part of it. And to get to £1 billion since 1981, I really don't think it was something that my father or John Disley thought about in 1981, but I think they both would be absolutely incredibly proud of the events getting to that stage now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a staggering amount of money.
I think just to add to it, I think that it's not only the runners and perhaps the charities that benefit, but all runners. The way that the charity cheer stations add to the course, the way that, you know, that it's become such a celebrated part of having the charities
definitely,
having their set
definitely.
Spot. I think that adds to everyone running, if you're running for charity or not, you get this wave of noise as you hit certain like points along the course. I think that's so important to the whole thing as well.
Yeah.
You are so right that the colour, the vibrancy, that's what is so unique about London, I think, is the crowd engagement and the feeling that you get. I mean, in life, there are very few things, very few times that people want you to be successful. If you've got if you've got four or five friends that are going, I really want you to be successful, that's incredible.
Yeah.
But on that day, on those streets in London, you put your name on your vest, your T-shirt, whatever it is, you will have tens of thousands of people shouting your name, willing you to be successful, to cross that finish line, to raise money for charity, to have improved yourself, to have remembered someone. And that sea of positivity, that feeling is so unique and is so much what London, the London Marathon is about. And that's why year in, year out, people want to do the event, why they're inspired to enter. And look, we would love to be able to put on far more of them, but it is so special, that feeling, and it is something to be treasured, and really does get remembered by people.
You know, it's Mo versus Kipchoge in the men's race. How excited are you to see those two battle it out on the streets of London?
I mean, enormously exciting. Yeah. I think look, that's exciting, but the women's race, everyone is talking about it as the greatest women's field ever put together. And, you know, I think where you have David Weir on his 20th London Marathon appearance.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, anyone training for a marathon, how hard is it to get to the start line in terms of illness or injury? And yet he's done it 20 times and won it 8 of those 20. I don't know of any athletic performance that is comparable. I mean, Sir Steve Redgrave in with his rowing over the 5 Olympic gold medals, I believe that was over 16 years. I mean, absolutely incredible. It ranks up there. So I think, you know, we have so many amazing stories going on this year that will be going on. But Sir Mo Farah, we supported him. London Marathon supported him as a younger athlete through St. Mary's College, and while he was there, to see, you know, to be part of effectively what he has achieved as Britain's greatest distance runner, possibly the world's greatest in terms of Olympic and World Championship medals, and then to see him break the British record in London to go on to be the first male able-bodied winner of an Abbott World Marathon Major and winning the Chicago Marathon and breaking the European record, and now to be coming back to London to go against Eliud Kipchoge, who what he did in Berlin in September last year,
phenomenal.
You know, was just, yeah, I mean, he beat the world record by 78 seconds. To be running 105 400 metres without a rest in 68 seconds, you know, go out and try and run 400 metres
in 68 seconds.
And then he did 105 of them. I mean, it's just quite incredible. And for that to be happening on the streets of London, and the inspiration, and it's enormously exciting. And really looking forward to this year.
Definitely.
I mean, I think the current state of the marathon is just, it's just become this great phenomenon. But what's your vision for the event over the next 10 years? Is there still wiggle room for improvement? Are you guys constantly striving for more?
Oh, massive, massive wiggle room. You know, we have a business plan. We have, you know, part of our vision is in inspiring activity and as I say, a mission to really make running and sport accessible to everybody. We do a survey of all the runners at the end of the marathon. And what is incredible is that we get about 11,000 responses.
Mm.
And we do go through them. There are field boxes where people can write their experience. And there are so many places that we can improve, and we're looking to improve. There's lots of announcements that we will be making about the 2019 marathon that haven't come out. Improvements that we're looking to make, as I've already said, trying to expand the number of people, potential additional events. There's lots of different things that we are looking at, and to inspire more people to get into the journey of running and sport and physical and mental health.
One final question to you, if that's all right. If someone's doing London for the first time this year, what advice have you got for them?
Firstly, make sure that you have, before the event, make sure that on your training runs that you have tried Lucozade and Lucozade gels beforehand.
Right.
What you don't want to be doing is getting onto the course, if you've been using some other product, you don't want to be trying something for the first time.
Yep.
So that principle of make sure that whatever clothing you're wearing, shoes you're wearing, it's not the first time that you've done it. You've done some long runs in it, you've tried it, you understand what it's done. That would be number one.
Yeah.
So don't do things for the first time.
That's good.
Number two, would be put your name on your vest, your top, go down beforehand to a put into Google printing on vests or printing on t-shirts, yeah. Go to your shop, get your name on it. That would be number two. And number three would be have fun. Don't feel pressured by doing a time. It is the most unbelievable experience. It is something that if you're doing it for the first time, you will remember for a long, long time. And just try and take it in and smile and appreciate the incredible positivity of London coming together and the biggest ever street party. And you're one of 42,000 people who happen to be running 26.2 miles around one of the most beautiful capital cities in the world. And people are there to support you. So just smile, have fun and lap it up.
Sounds good. Hugh, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us on the Runners World podcast. It was fantastic to hear a bit more about the marathon, and we look forward to it next month.
Yeah, I'm excited already now. That's really great. That's really got it going.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, and look forward to working with your pacers and making sure that everyone gets onto their target times.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Cheers, Hugh. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Thanks, Hugh.
This is the Runners World podcast.
One of the biggest things in the headlines this month, and one that has caused a lot of debate, is the IAAF's decision to scrap the 5,000 and 10,000 metre events at the Diamond League from 2020 onwards. The longest distance at those events will be 3,000 metres. Kerry, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, you know, to get serious for a moment, I think it's a mistake. There's no two ways about it. You've only got to cast your mind back to August 2012, Super Saturday and all that, Mo Farah winning Olympic gold in the 5,000 metres and the 10,000 metres. Not the only occasion on which he's done that. He's repeated the trick since. You know, these events can be incredibly engaging and dramatic. You know, I just think, A, there are other ways to breathe new life into distance running, into track and field meets generally, without cutting back on the longer distances. Quick example, if you take the night of the 10,000 metre PBs.
Yeah, it's a great night.
In North London, where people can come onto the track and sort of stand at the edge of lane three. While the elites, Joe Pavey and all the rest, are herring round, have a beer. You know, it's almost kind of like, I think we've said this before, but it's the closest thing we've got to almost like a Tour de France stage, where people are that close to the athletes 100%. And the atmosphere they're creating. So there are ways of doing it. And I'm really surprised that Seb Coe has come out and, you know, he's kind of said...
What distance is
it? He said that, you know, the sport needs to change and, you know, this and that. And they were all sort of fairly platitudinous comments, I think. Just the final point that I make is that we are all here because we do distance running. Yeah. You know, we work at Runners World. The readers read Runners World and listen to this podcast because presumably they do events from 5K upwards, which is kind of like our heartland. They're not track athletes and sprinters. And so to disconnect this vast and growing sort of population of runners who are discovering this sport for their own reasons, for charity, for mental health, for fitness, for general health, whatever else, from the elites that are trying to set an example that we're trying to connect them to, it just kind of seems a bit arse about face.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
It's often been said that running is a 90% mental game, but how do we get ourselves in the best shape mentally perform on race day? With marathon season fast approaching, we thought it best to speak to someone in the know, so we are joined by Andy Lane, Professor of Sports Psychology at the University of Wolverhampton. Andy, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
What are some of the hallmarks for mentally tough athletes? What can everyday runners do to try and replicate those who've found that mental toughness?
Well, they can do a lot, and first is to appreciate and recognise that you've entered a marathon and it's going to be tough. It's going to be 26.2 miles. It doesn't come easy, and that's for whether you do it quickly or it takes you a bit longer. So the first is to recognise that, and recognise that the difficult parts mentally come at the back end, and to get yourself some experience of what those feelings are like. So, I mean, it's part, you know, all the training sort of goes to, we talk about the physical part, but actually those long runs are as much about training the mind so that you can keep going at the intensity you want to when it really starts to suffer. because it's going to be hard, and it's accepting that. And the second key thing is patience. You really do need patience. You need patience in the early stages to keep calm. You need patience to make the right decision. Those two things together are really key for marathon performance.
So does that mean, Andy, then, that in your opinion, mental strength is learned rather than innate? Or is it the case that some runners are just born risk takers and others are kind of destined to operate comfortably below their potential?
Well, certainly, I think it can be learned. I think you can get much tougher mentally, and the training effect of that is huge. But I also think that people have a lot more mental toughness than they realise, and it only takes some activation of that before they are really, really mentally tough. So it's there, and you just got to activate it.
When you talk about activation, is there sort of easy techniques? Is this sort of, or is it, as you said before, the long run and the actual active act of doing these things is what activates these things?
Well, I mean, it's the you'll get there through experience, which is the doing long runs, doing training sessions which are hard, when talking yourself into keep going. That's experience. But you can expedite that experience by doing mental training and by training in a way that that says this is going to be tough and we're going to teach our mind to do so. So the mental training part of that would be to develop your relationship with fatigue at the back end of a long run of a marathon. What are the thoughts that go through your head? It's going to feel hard. At what point do you say, I'm now going to reduce the effort? And reducing the effort and reducing the speed or is going to lead you slowing down. And then you say to yourself, how will I feel about if it takes me X time to complete? And that is an emotional response. You play out those emotional responses. Mm. So, I mean, I had hundreds of goes trying to get to 3 hours.
Yeah.
And the idea that you get to 2 hours, 40 minutes in, you've got just nearly 3 miles to go, and it's hard.
Yeah.
And the conversation is that it's really hard now. It's really hard. At the moment, it might well be that you might say, actually, there's a marathon in 2 months' time. I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll just ease off a bit now and I'll save myself for that. So you slow down and miss it by 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, whatever it is, as your goal slightly moves about. If you have that conversation beforehand, and if you are going to miss your goal, how are you going to feel? Are you going to feel guilty, upset with yourself? Typically, outside, when we do this in the cold, in the thinking, before training, at home, we will go, well, we weren't very happy with that. And so those unpleasant emotions then can feed forwards to go, actually, I don't really want that. And therefore, I'm going to learn to coach myself through those really difficult moments.
So I was going to ask, Andy, with regards to, you know, when you're approaching your maximum in a race, it is incredibly easy to give in to the voice, that little voice inside your head that wants to slow down or quit. I was going to ask how you can quiet it down, but it sounds like you're saying your ability to quiet it down will come from all the work that you've done before race day rather than any magic bullets that you can come up with at that moment.
Oh, yeah, you know, firstly, your relationship, you always expect it to come, and that you work so hard that it comes. So you go, here you are, you've come. Now you are. It's 23 miles. Here you are. You're now telling me to slow down. Right. And at that point, you want other techniques to talk yourself out of that or put your mind somewhere else. So those then might well be to do imagery of smooth, efficient running. So when that voice comes in, you might want to put in your head an image of smooth, efficient running. You might want, which if you've practiced it, you'll be able to get that image in your head, play it as if it's on a cinema screen of your forehead, and that's the bit you concentrate on. But you'll be watching that film with a narrative of someone telling you to slow down, but you've got the conflict in your goals and your mind going, actually, I don't want to slow down. I have committed to this goal, and that's what we're sticking to.
So the key is to have done it and practiced it in advance in training, in the same way that you've trained your legs, you've trained your brain.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, that would be one technique. Another technique would be a mental lasso on the person ahead of you. And you watch their legs going round, and you imagine that they're actually running your legs.
Oh, I like that.
I like that one. I've never heard that one.
So you concentrate on their legs. Works brilliantly in cycling as well, because it's cycling so rhythmical. And rather than running, is you find someone who's running around your cadence, and you make a mental lasso to them, and you go, "Oh, they're going to be running my legs."
Andy, I think we've spoken a lot about sort of techniques that people should be doing, but are there things that sort of common errors that people make before the marathon to mentally prepare that they can avoid doing?
There are, and I think partly it's in the goals people set regarding their expected time, and there's so many unknowns in a marathon, and many people haven't got a really good relationship between their running speed after 20 miles, and so and you see many people, the idea that you start out slow and you're going to somehow save yourself is really quite difficult. And then around that would be the avoidance of really strong negative statements to yourself if you have to walk for a bit.
Right.
Because I think that's okay. And I think what people can do in training, again, is learn to walk, run, so they can then learn to talk themselves back into feeling okay again. And learning to, and go, actually, it's rather than be really...
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Brutal and wrecking the enjoyment of it. Because, I mean, you know, London, lots of people are going to be in London. 5 hours has typically got bits in where there's periods of short bits of walking. It's not, you don't want to make it negatively. You want to make it into a negative experience.
No, you know what, Andy? I 100% agree with that. I've never really understood when people say, oh, did you do the marathon? Yes. Did you run the whole way? As though that's somehow like marathon plus. And you did the distance, you got your medal, your time is your time, and however you achieve that, as long as you ran the full distance, it almost doesn't matter, I've always thought. And there's an American coach called Jeff Galloway, who is a strong advocate of the run-walk method. And I remember several years ago, he took a group of athletes who were struggling to break 3:15, and he introduced walking into their training, and several of them smashed it.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
So walking doesn't equal weakness or slowness. I mean, it's tactical.
Yeah.
And also, I think it gives the body a small reprieve. You know, the recovery of a bit of a walk, and you're suddenly the muscles are under less duress and things like that. You can kind of flush a bit of lactate out and those sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's funny, really, because in cycling, no one has a go at the cyclists if they just roll down the hill, do they?
No.
No one has a go. Running hasn't got that little bit of a break. If you're going to spend and 5 hours of hard exercise is a lot of effort.
Yeah.
I think people don't really give the people who do 4 or 5 hours the credit, because a lot of them are really working hard for a long period of time. And the gap between the cruising speed and going a slow speed isn't always there. It's as they're running, it's quite hard.
Yeah.
So it's quite hard running or not. And it's for a long period of time. And if we had a 2:30 marathon runner, it's like, we all have got to crack that. You've got to crack your, really, it's your 10K pace. And they'd go, well, I can't do it. I have to run, walk. And you go, okay, well, that's fine. And we'd all accept that because it's super fast. And we aren't so accepting of people for whom the physiological effect of running is really quite intense. And therefore, there is some recovery required outside of that.
Mm.
Is needed, and it's not as. And the other bit is that it is actually quite hard to do, I think. And for anyone who says that you should run the whole way, they should do Snowdonia Marathon. Right? They should, because at 23 or 24 miles, there is the steepest, longest hill. Right? Yeah. It must be about a mile and a half long, and anyone who's done it will have done that. And you try to run up it, and then you get passed by people walking.
Yeah.
Because it's functionally quicker to walk up it really quickly.
Andy, we're going to round off with one question, which I think is probably, if our listeners could sum up all their kind of anguish about grit and mental strength, this would probably be the big question. Maybe we should put like a big question sting in here afterwards.
Big question.
And it's this. Does the wall really exist, or does it appear just because we expect it to?
See, I don't think it does exist, really. I don't think how many runners who are feeling the wall, have you ever tested whether a tiger would energise them next to them? A big, stripy tiger appears on the course, and you say, I've given up, I've got no more energy.
Yeah, it's true.
A big, stripy tiger turns
You resign yourself to being eaten because of the wall.
Do you think you'd get funding for research in that area?
There hasn't been much. I mean, the gap in research is that it doesn't set the motivational, doesn't set the context so that the motivational aspects of the human are really tested. You know, you see Johnny Brownlee crumble at the end.
Yeah.
But we put people on treadmills and we push them to supposedly exhaustion and they stop and that's all well and good. But the motivational requirement to really nail it isn't there.
Right.
Isn't there, and it's I don't think we know a lot about that part where someone really, really digs really deep to push themselves, because people find an enormous amount of extra energy, of extra resource when they want it. That's why I think when I said that some people have got more than what they think they have.
Yeah,
I did a load of research on the psychology of pain, how people cope through trauma, through difficult situations, and you get. You hear the narrative comments, and they're awful to read, but they come from women in childbirth, they come from people in unexpected traumas where they had no skills, where they've been caught by terrorists, and this is how they cope. And you think, crikey, humans are resilient when they need to be. Mm. And they find ways of coping and dealing with difficult things.
So what you're saying is we need to parachute some club runners into the big cat enclosure at the West Midlands Zoo and see what happens.
I think that would create amusement.
No, that makes sense, Andy. And actually, that's really heartening to hear that. To some extent, it's all in our head. Because next time it happens, I certainly know with me, I won't be going, well, this is just a physiological thing that's happening to my body, and I can't help it. I'll be thinking, well, actually, you can push through this.
Yeah, you can do, but you can't. It's not. You take the physical and mental training together. That's what I think is really important. So when you're doing the hard training sessions, you're also training the brain. And so therefore, you'll learn to pull those extra bits out. And those experiences will come from training, because you've done it before and you can do it again.
Andy, thank you so much for joining us. I think this afternoon I will go and reintroduce myself to some endurance fatigue. And remember it for later use.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
We've all run using distance or time as a metric, but how about using power to grade your effort? It might sound like something that's a bit more applicable to cyclists, because it has been up until now. But runner and tech guru, who put that word in here?
Thank you very much.
It's true. Tech guru Kieran Alger has been doing precisely this. And with great results, I believe, running a sub 3 hour, or I should say
another sub 3 hour marathon, because the little sod's done it before, in Hamburg earlier this year. He's here in the studio, obviously, and to tell us all about running by power, it is Kieran. Hello.
Hi, guys. How are you doing? Thanks for that great intro. Yeah,
you're welcome.
Great intro. The PB and the guru in one sentence is
you can tell
it's
that
not often done.
I rehearsed it remorselessly beforehand. Tell us more about how you've been using power to grade your effort when you're training.
Yeah, so I guess if you go back, I ran my first sub 3 probably about 5 years ago in London, and since then I've tried maybe 5 or 6 times to hit sub 3 again, using a normal kind of training plan. And this time I decided actually to try and do something different, because I've basically run and bust. So I would go out at a pretty sort of killer pace, and you'd be doing that thing where it's such a fine line that you either make it or you fail miserably. And I kept coming in at 3:11s, 3:25s, and basically wheels would fall off at 18 miles. So I thought, okay, we'll try something different. We'll use power in training and then in race day. And what power has sort of offered me is a way to, it basically is an additional metric to improve the insights when you're training. Mm. So we'll go into it in a bit more detail, but it does things like it can flatten hills out. So if you're running in an area which is particularly hilly and you need to do a 10 mile at marathon pace, let's say, what are you going to do when you hit those hills? Do you carry on at marathon pace or do you ease back? If you carry on at marathon pace, you're going to basically putting too much load into the system, or more load than your coach or your training plan is recommending. So you can use power because you can ease off and keep the power number the same up the hill as it is on the flat. Mm. So you can have a consistent effort with a consistent power. So it's really useful for guiding training.
Well, that makes sense, because it's similar to kind of doing it on heart rate, where obviously you could leg it up the hill and your heart rate would go up, but you maintain it at the same level. But at the risk of, you know, sounding a bit like a dummy, you know, for the benefit of our listeners, what is power, and what are the units of measurement?
So it's measured in watts, and, you know, it's been used in cycling for a long time as a way of sort of measuring consistent output. It's a little bit more complicated with running in order to take the measurements, because you haven't got a fixed position. So you have to really think about power in running, and all the devices that track it really as sort of benchmark stats. They're not actual power output, if you were to sort of think about it scientifically necessarily. Yeah. But it's basically the power generated when your feet are pushing off from the floor. So the technology in the sensors, the foot sensors, or even in the watches, are looking at movement of that sensor above the ground and below the ground and around in 3D
space. Vertical oscillation, how far your foot moves is how quickly it's pushed off the floor, or how high it gets above the floor.
It's all of those things together to calculate power. So it's a bit, you know, if you think about the speed of which you're pushing off, that's one measurement. How high you'll go. It also takes into account elevation gain, with some devices using GPS, so it can see when you're going uphill, and it computes all of this into a figure, which is basically your power output. And I guess the really interesting thing when you talked about heart rate is that heart rate takes a little while to catch up. So if you run up a hill, your heart rate readings will only actually get to where your heart rate is in the real world after maybe 15, 20 seconds.
Right.
Power gives you a reading of that effort and that intensity from the very get-go. So it's brilliant for things like if you're going to do an interval session, you know you're hitting the right effort or the right intensity from the very first interval, rather than having to wait for your heart rate to warm up. So it's very useful from that point of view.
So the advantages there are obviously that, you know, it's a metric that's pretty instantaneous in data feedback and sort of levelling off the things. But have you found any real disadvantages with it?
It's one of the, you have to be, I mean, I guess people will, it'd be easy to sort of listen to this and sort of think, oh, not another metric. You know, it's very complicated. It's a very simple premise, really. It is, you can use it just like pace.
Yeah.
So you look at one number and you say, I'm going to run this race at 350 watts. Because that is the power threshold that I know I can maintain for 26 miles. And if you stay at that, you have a nice, even, consistent pacing. And that's a really nice thing. And that's the same as you trying to run at, you know, at 6:30s or 7-minute miles. Yeah. Only you can, again, when you hit the hills, you don't have to adjust. One of the downsides, I guess, is that power can fluctuate from step to step. So you have to be, if you're going to use power and you've got a device, I would really highly recommend that you set it to an average. So you get an average over a period of time.
Yeah.
So it evens it out a bit. You're not every step thinking, oh, my God, now I'm doing 700 watts, and now I'm doing 2, now I'm doing 7.
Because you take the cycling metric, when you view power in cycling, it's about max effort or like consistent effort up a climb, and it's kind of like graded in that way. It wouldn't be used. I don't think it's only really used in time trials where it's a consistent high level output. So if someone's looking at their power and they're trying to race like an individual 25 mile something, then they'll know that they need to sit at 400 and something watts. Whereas for running, it's more of a leveler rather than a sort of threshold kind of power sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you an example of where I used it in training that really helped me. I ran a half marathon, which was a trail half marathon, very hilly, very hot day. So there's lots of conditions that would affect how my heart rate is, what my pacing would be. And I ran on power. And I ran to a steady power, which was you know, within my ability. I knew it was within my ability. And I ran my second quickest half marathon, but it was completely evenly paced, even though there was hills and heat. And by the end of it, you know, normally we're talking about the kind of hitting the wall. Mm. That doesn't really happen because you're controlling yourself. You're basically under a threshold. So I ran my best, most comfortable half marathon I've ever run. You know, that last 3 miles that normally make you feel sick and that you hate.
Don't know what you're talking about.
That didn't happen. But I find it really useful for pacing in that sense. Oh,
so, okay, but... So one thing I'm trying to get my head around, let's say, okay, almost everybody, whether you're a beginner or a grizzled club veteran, is familiar with the concept of pace. And let's say you're training for a marathon and you want to break 4 hours. So you know that maintaining 9 minute miles will bring you in at 3:56.
Yeah.
So you can then work out your training program, all the long steady runs, the tempo runs, the interval training based on that time.
Yeah.
How do you work out what power setting, if you like, you run at if you're a layman? Because that's like, okay, how do I do that?
It depends on the device. So with the Stride running pod, there's actually a couple of tests that you can do in the app. So it says, I can't remember the exact detail, but you'll go and do...
Is that the preeminent running power meter device?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And, you know, I think from a foot sensor, yes, if you want the convenience of just running with your watch, then, you know, Polar's Vantage V is pretty good because you don't have to have an accessory. But you can in Stride, you can do two or three different types of tests in the app. You go to the track and do a number of repeats, and from that it will gauge and set your power limits. And there's a calculator in there. It's really easy. You hit a button and it says, for a marathon or for a half marathon, this is your threshold power, and that's the number that you have to run to. So
I've done a bit with power now with the Stride pod, and
right.
I think it's like exactly like how do I use this as a useful thing? And I think that it's like with anything you take. So say your example of 4 hours. So if you're doing 9 minute miles, you might become familiar with a heart rate that equates to that pace. Now what I found with was that if you're suddenly another metric's just appearing next to that, which you then learn how it behaves. So it's not necessarily you'll adopt it immediately, but it's another one of those things that like, oh right. So if I'm doing 4 hours, so I know that 9 minute mile, so I looked at my pace and I learnt that pace, and I learnt that that pace equated to a 145 BPM heart rate. All right, great. Well, look, if I now look at the power that's next to this, oh, it says 320 watts, and that seems consistent.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
So
they all sort of, it's another one in the arsenal of metrics. It's not just a...
Yeah.
And but the great level, the great reason why it's useful is, as Kieran says, the examples of hills and stuff like that is
you. And you can, I guess, the other thing is you can set all of your runs if you wanted to. If you wanted to go that deep into it, you could run all of your training runs by power. So you can do threshold sessions based on power set thresholds, or you can do your long runs based on a power setting rather than a pace setting.
So in terms of how easy it is for the layman to interpret power data, it's a question of putting that metric in on your data field screen alongside existing ones which you're already familiar with, so that over a period of a few weeks or a couple of months, you get to know what means what.
Yeah, it's a good way of using, like, familiarising yourself with the whole thing, yeah.
Just have a play. I mean, it's just interesting even just to pop it on there and see, particularly if you're running routes that go up and down, it's quite funny to see how much power you're putting in at different points and, you know, how actually even small inclines take a lot more out of you than you think.
Okay, so if I'm used to doing intervals at a certain pace, but then I start to train by power, and the suggested wattage it's giving me is actually making me run slower than I normally do, Do I then kind of take that to mean, actually, you've been doing this pace, but you're not really fit enough to do that, Kerry? What you need to do to sustain it is this slower pace and just suck it up and get on with it.
Oh, that's a really good question. So if your pace is... You're basically running at the wattage and running at a slower pace
than you've traditionally done. Is that like a good revelation of like, actually, this is my level, I need to stop deluding myself?
It would suggest to me that the power setting that you're trying to run to is probably set too low, rather than there's something with your own fitness. So that wattage that you're running to, you probably have more capacity. If you're used to running at a 6:30, all of a sudden you're running at a wattage that is making you run at 8 minutes. You've clearly got a bit of room to go, and you can up the wattage. So in that sense, it's these things are very relatable. So you could literally see it as an alternative pace in that sense.
Okay. No, so that's super interesting. But I think we should probably move off power now.
I love talking about power.
Until
I know.
This is it. We've until everyone's just like overloaded with power chat.
Yeah.
You've been exploring how running tech can help match you with the shoes of your dreams. So it's actually a feature on Runner's World on the website at the moment, which people can go and read. So, but just to elaborate on that, people are so used to a gait analysis and an inner shop staring at a wall of shoes, but it's come a long way.
It's moved on a lot, and I think we're still sort of in the early stages. But I love the idea. You go into a running shoe shop. We've probably all done it. You go up, you look at that big wall, you pick up a pair of shoes. You probably bend them a bit. You sort of weigh them in your hands, which are not scales, by the way, people. And actually, there's a lot of tests to show that this is a really, really not a good way to be weighing a shoe. And then we pick a colour that we like, or we run a bit in it. But there's a lot of technology that's coming on board now that can really help us to understand what's going on in each pair of shoes when we run in them from a data point of view. So there's a one company called Dorsa V who have a set of sensors that you wear on your shins. You jump on a treadmill for 2 minutes in each pair of shoe, and it comes back with data on your running efficiency and your running economy that can help you identify which shoes you run best in.
And that sounds like something that a shoe, like a running shop, could have in store, and let people just try out 4 different pairs of shoes and all that sort of stuff.
So some specialist running stores will have this already. And it's really interesting. I've done this test, and the shoes that I thought I really ran well in, or I really liked my natural sort of choice of shoe, which was quite a minimal, lightweight. Actually, I run really much better in sort of something that's a bit heavier and has a bit more stability.
Right.
Which was, I didn't want to hear that news, but it's interesting.
That raises an interesting point. 2 years ago at the London Marathon Expo, Runners World Deputy Editor Joe Mackey and myself we had meetings with several of the brands in attendance there. And 3 brands had different types of gait analysis technology, which they were showcasing. So we got ourselves assessed on each of them. And you know what's coming? we got given different kind of readouts.
Yeah.
And one brand said I needed a neutral shoe. One brand said that I needed a kind of like a mild overpronation shoe. And another one said that I needed a massive brick sort of motion control shoe.
Yeah.
And when you listened to the presentations from the biomechanists and stuff that they had there, on the surface, it all sounds quite compelling. But, you know, you get to the end of the process and you're like, clearly, I can't need all 3 of these. 2 of these guys are wrong.
Sure. But that's what I think is, when I love tech, but this is where I think tech can solve some of that problem, because you don't get subjective opinion and analysis. You get hard data saying, in these shoes, your running form was like this, and your ground contact time was quicker, you know, the amount of energy that you're wasting in certain areas was more in these shoes than other shoes. And you get a report that shows you your efficiency. So another interesting piece of technology that does this, ASICS have just put together, they've taken all of the data they've got with their professional lab setup, where they're doing, you know, motion capture and pressure plate work to assess how runners run over however many years, thousands of data points, put it all into a system, and they're using that so that you can hold an iPad up, video yourself running on a treadmill, and it then uses an algorithm and the data they've already got to tell you how you run and how your running efficiency scores are. So if you can see it in cold, hard numbers, actually it removes some of that subjective sort of thing that you'll get when you go into a running store.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, though, Kerry, I mean, I think that you basically have to, you can't take out the humans entirely. If you put those shoes on and you think, I hate the colour, I can't possibly run a sub three in orange shoes, then don't buy them, you know.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say, do we really need technology to tell us which shoes we should be wearing? I'm sure there's going to be a large sort of number among our listeners who, like, some of them will be like, yeah, I need all the tech and marginal gains information that I can get my hands on. And some will be like, dude, I just run twice a week for a bit of health and I just want something comfortable. Yeah. Isn't it a case of, these are comfortable, they suit me, my needs, they're within my budget. Why complicate things?
I think you're now talking about two very different runners. I think you're talking about the people who, as you say, run twice a week and are comfortable in their shoes, and that is all that matters to them in terms of, like, getting out the door. And then I think there's possibly people within our remit who are like, enjoy the data and perhaps, like, feel that if there's a way of someone optimizing a running performance or a running experience, and that is by having someone analyze my running form using technology to tell me that actually that shoe is better than this shoe, I would buy into that straight away.
But also, don't forget, there's also those people who are more casual runners. The injury factor comes in.
Yep.
You know, putting you in the right shoes that can help you avoid injury or look at how shoes affect your different running style. It gets down to sort of being very unique and a bit more bespoke.
I think it's just how much of a nerd you are, right?
If you're more geeky, you're gonna enjoy this more. I want a future where I'm running in my shoes day to day, and at some point they tell me these are no longer the right shoes for you, or just hang me up.
Your shoes will physically stop moving. This is not working out. It's you, not me.
Put me back in the cupboard immediately.
Do you think we're approaching a time when this kind of tech-led personalization of footwear will be pretty commonplace? I know 3D printing and stuff in production processes, and
I just think it's such a commercial opportunity for brands to have a better relationship. So, you know, forever, well, basically until now, you buy a pair of shoes, you take them home, and that's the end of your relationship with a brand. If you can put chips in shoes that are starting to gather data, that are watching or quantifying how you run and how you're running, the brands can start to have
connected
shoes. You're starting to have a more two-way relationship, and that's commercially valuable for these guys. But also, I think just, it could be very interesting from a user perspective as well, because your shoes are going to teach you a whole lot more about your needs and what you need. So I can only really see it going one way, particularly because to get into the nitty-gritty of the costs of putting these kind of sensors in shoes is coming down. So you can actually buy a pair of shoes at the same price point with sensors in them as not. So you kind of might as well have them.
So these shoes with technology in them, I think that the phrase is connected shoes, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you had to, you know, presumably that's not a term for shoes with a really impressive little black book. So how would you explain what they are? Is it literally any type of tech in a shoe, or is it a particular type of tech that means it's a connected shoe?
I see connected shoes as shoes that have embedded sensors, so Bluetooth sensors, motion tracking sensors that will connect to an app or maybe direct to a computer, and they'll fire stats and information back to a smartphone.
So they're kind of almost replacing smartwatches or, you know, GPS training watches.
I think they'll actually be a layer on top. So, you know, you're always going to want your stats where you can see them. And I think on your wrist is obviously the best place. But if you think about right now, we've got Stride, which is a foot pod that sits on top of the shoe. It's an extra accessory.
Yeah.
Most of the work that Stride does could be done built into your shoe and just fire that data to your watch. So I don't see it replacing a watch. I see it as a sort of bringing additional metrics to your watch.
And the sort of the insoles that you add to your shoes, of Arion and those guys and the tech that they're bringing out, you know, that there's no way that bigger brands wouldn't adopt similar things, but in a standard insole rather than an additional layer that you add in. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know Under Armour have been having a go with a couple of their recent versions with a kind of mixed degree of success. I think the general viewpoint is it works and it's nice and keep going. We'd want to explore this further, but I think, you know, there've been sort of Bluetooth connectivity issues and stuff like that.
It's not tracking enough metrics for me now. It's not bringing enough,
and it's always post run
difference. There's the real time coaching, Ben, right? So you can, you know, if the shoes are starting to help you understand what's going on in your run real time and helps provide information,
yeah.
But it's one of the great things, I think, one of the leaps they've made is that the sensors don't need charging. So all the ones that we had in, before from Nike and Adidas, you had to charge the chips, sensors. These shoes, they last. You don't have to plug them in. They're just, as your other running shoes, you pop them on, they automatically connect to the app and you're out. And you can run with them and track even without your phone, which is also a nice bit. Yeah. So there's little things that are showing there's quite a bright future for this.
Do you know what? I've just had a little sort of glimpse into the future when you talked about brands having more of a relationship with you, and they'll be able to tell, in the same way when you don't go to the gym for a bit and you get that email saying, come on, don't give up, come to the gym. Brands will be like, haven't been for a run for 4 days.
Think about how anyone who's got an Apple Watch or a smartwatch in general, that pings at you, stand up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Haven't reached your move goal. You know, that interaction between tech is not one way anymore.
I can imagine like Nike somehow like partnering with the alarm function on your phone, and you wake up to Mo Farah's voice saying, get up,
come on,
put your trainers on.
I mean, the next release in the run app will be that. Exactly. Right, we've talked enough tech. Let's talk about running in its purest form. So Hamburg, you PB'd. Congratulations. Was it a PB or was it just the under 3 target?
It was a PB.
Great.
If you count, I don't know if this counts. You guys might be able to clarify this for me because some people have questioned it. I did a 50 second PB, so it was 2:57.05 down from 2:57.56. Does that
let me be very clear about this. If your time is a microsecond quicker than anything you've run before, it is a PB.
Congratulations.
I'm just shaking Kerry's hand here, right, by the way. Thank you very much.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's clear that up for everyone.
So you've done that, and that was actually quite a long-term project, wasn't it, using different training techniques and all those sorts of things. So
yes.
You've done it.
Yep.
What's next?
So next I am going back to a race that's beaten me twice already. It's called the Lavaredo. It's a 120-kilometre mountain ultra in the Dolomites in Italy. And I'm not going to lie, twice it's kicked my ass. I've got to... Year one, I got to 95 kilometres. Year two, I got to 93.
Oof.
It's obviously good, getting worse. I took a year off last year because my family didn't want to go to Italy again. And I've managed to convince everyone that we can go back this year and give it a third and final crack.
This is it, final.
And this is it, yeah. So this is my... This is get serious time, basically. I have to finish this race this time or it won't happen.
Well, we've got an interview on this very episode of this podcast with Professor Andy Lane about mental strength and grit and all that kind of jiggery.
And you've been there twice before,
you should listen to it this time.
I will definitely be listening to that. I might listen to it whilst I'm running, just when it gets to the hard bits.
Good, yeah. Perfect. Well, Kieran, thanks so much for joining us. I'm hoping that has swayed a few more people to embrace some technology in their runs, just to help them along their way.
I don't see how it can fail to do so. That was incredibly lucid.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Cheers.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So that brings us to the end of this month's Runner's World podcast. I want to say a big thank you to our guests, Hugh Brashear, Professor Andy Lane, Kieran Alger, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this was recorded.
For more from Runner's World, why not visit our website, runnersworld.com/UK, where you'll find more news, reviews, and interviews from the wide world of running.
If you like what you've heard, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and give us a rating. Thanks very much for listening, and we will see you next month.
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.